Pastor Dan is gone, and also Pastor Tony, so we get to have a party. No, okay, maybe not the best plan at the moment. But I'm really excited to be with you guys. Today I'm going to be talking about something that Pastor Tony actually gave me as a topic for upstairs. Because I'm doing both sermons, and I'm slightly lazy sometimes, I decided to do the same sermon twice. So, rerun for some of you. Anyways, but the topic, what he's going through is he's going through the disruptive church. He's going through this whole thing about where in Acts has there been disruption within the church system, moving from the Jewish culture into a Christ follower. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today, is disruption within Acts in a very specific way. So let's pray before we get started. Dear God, thank you so much for today. Thank you so much for everything that you've let us be part of. Thank you for this community, for everyone here, those that couldn't be here, and just help us to be able to have an experience with you. We love you so much. In your name, amen. Amen. I still remember this one particular day in seminary where I had just finished skipping class, which was nothing anyone in college or high school should ever do, but I had just finished skipping class because there was a really pretty tree outside and I had a bagel, and so I had to obviously sit in the tree and eat the bagel. And so I got out of the tree and I started running to my next class because I realized at that point I'm late. And as I run up the steps, I'm like halfway up a step and I hear someone say, "Hey, I've seen you around." And I was like, "Yes." And so I turn around and the guy says, "Are you a seminarian?" And I was like, "Yes." Because who really knows what that means when you think about it? When people ask questions like that, you assume that they're asking a question that's not the question they're asking, because it's kind of a weird one. So I was like, "Yeah." And he was like, "Oh, okay. And then he says, "So you want to be a pastor?" And I said, "Never." But let me remind you, at this point, I was still actually a clinical chaplain, so I really wasn't planning on being a pastor again. And so then he goes, "Oh, okay. Do you do ministry?" And I was like, "Ministry?" He was like, "Yeah, are you good at ministry?" And I realized he's making piano motions to me, and I was like, "Not really." And he was like, "Oh, because I think we could do ministry well together." And then he'd made the motions of the piano again. And I was like, okay, good times. And I started laughing in his face, which is not a mature moment that I've had. I've had a lot of those moments where I like burst out laughing in his face, but I just started laughing because I didn't know what to do now with this man standing in front of me telling me that my ministry was dictated off of my ability to play piano. And you see, today, Tony asked me to speak on a group of people in this Acts movement that we're being called to join the disruptive community in a new way. While in seminary, I learned a lot about my life and about me. You see, I learned that there are very different roles that are perceived to be for pastors, women, ministers, basically anyone involved in leadership. I found that much of the time I didn't realize that so much of my identity was based off of my gender. I found that my ability to minister was tainted by someone's view by the fact that I'm just a woman. There have been countless times where I have stood in front of several people that were using words as arrows, hoping to pop a dream or say something that maybe would shut down some motion or something like that. And I started realizing that so many people were in these moments of my life and they were telling me that I can't do something, and I only would come to then realize that we can do that thing. And that we are allowed to be doing that thing. And half the time, it's not even really about that thing. It's about something completely different. And it truly is how we handle the things that people throw at us that matter. In many of my classes, I found that my mere presence as a single theological woman was as alarming as a bunch of live bears running into the room, banging pots and pans and doing dances on the desks. They would sit there in weird amusement, horror, fear, can't stop staring, hope it never happens again kind of moments. And that's how a lot of my classes went and how a lot of people I came in contact would react when they would hear that I was doing what I was doing. This is what was happening in Acts. This is the same situation. Women were coming on the scene as more than the bearer of children and carrier of water. There are many places in Acts where female leaders, pastors, are described. Acts describes this disruption and chaos of the Jewish culture. Today we're talking about disruptive women. I'm almost have to get over myself to even speak on this topic. For years, the battle over women in ministry has stolen conversations at dinner tables or dreams of people that I care about and believe in. And I truly believe that they could have changed the world. For years, I have accidentally been the topic of conversation due to my extreme rebellion, even though my act of rebellion was becoming a pastor. I know. I could probably be more rebellious. In California, this just isn't a topic that is touchy as everywhere else that I've lived. I have so many stories where my mom has said to me, like, oh, I was in Indonesia or over here, and I couldn't even stand at the pulpit. They've had to put a special little podium at the bottom for me. That happened to me in my home church before I even moved here, as I did in one of my farewell sermons. I couldn't speak at the pulpit. I had to step aside. Inherently, that doesn't bother me. But I also have to be respectful of the places that people are in their emotional growth, in their ability to see what maybe there's a bigger picture at hand. And I also have to realize that sometimes when I go to another country and I stand there on the shore watching people I've been working with for several weeks and maybe even a month, watching them get baptized by someone that has never seen them before, I have to put my own self aside because I realize that maybe there's a bigger picture here. But it still hurts. It still hurts to stand there and realize that you can't say who you are or do the things that you were cut out to do. There are moments, even 2 weeks ago when I was in the Dominican visiting my family for my grandfather's funeral, where I started rehashing some moments where I couldn't actually tell people what I did. And for so long, I couldn't actually tell people, like, yeah, I'm a pastor, or I actually got ordained. And so when people asked me what I did, I would just say I work with people. And they're like, oh, okay, cool. And so many of the conversations were kind of derailed and pulled away because I had to be careful that I didn't want to ruin my grandparents' view of me or ruin any of their friendships. All because I was born the wrong gender to have a voice. I typically don't stand in front of people to say any of this because I feel like a lot of the time it just becomes self-serving. And I have a little bit of problem with that. If I prove that I deserve a voice or that women deserve a voice, well, I get a voice, right? That becomes all about me. But what about all the other people around us that don't have voices? What about the other people that are being shut down and squished and they can't speak up because no one else is advocating for them either? And so much of the time, I don't choose to actually talk on this topic. And you see, when you go through Acts, you start realizing that there's more to the story, and this is happening over and over. Many people read Acts or Timothy and see the silencing of women. Yet when you actually spend time reading them, you begin to realize that maybe surface reading isn't really what is happening at this moment. You have to remember, when reading ancient literature, there are several people at play here. There's the time and the guy who's writing it. There's the time and the people that are reading it. And then there's you and your time. There are three voices always happening when you're reading scripture. And so you have to realize that when you're reading, you have to respect those times as well. Reading a surface level can be enjoyable and good, and you can get so much out of it. But sometimes you have to look a little bit deeper and see what actually is happening in that moment. So here's one of my favorite Bible verses. 1 Timothy 2:11. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. As you guys know me, this is the perfect text for me. I know, right? I'm so silent. A few weeks ago, I was at a presentation, actually, on ancient literature and historical literature. And one of the presenters was presenting this concept, this very concept, and they actually used this text as an example. And, I was cackling in the background going, yeah, silence everyone. And this text has been used on me, actually, a few times. I used to come to my dorm room or my house when I was in Michigan. And actually, this text would often be on my door as a friendly reminder from one of my friends. And it honestly always made me smile. But listen to this. What the example was that they used was, imagine if there's a classroom nowadays, a college classroom, and the teacher gets up at the beginning of the semester and they say, all right, I'm so happy that all of you are here. Let's pretend this is a classroom. Except for the women, here's the deal for the semester. You can't ask questions. You can't participate in the discussion. You need to remain silent and in submission for the whole semester. Cool? How do you think that would go nowadays? Probably not super great. And so picture that moment. So when we read this, we're all like, no. Like, women should learn in quietness and full submission. Like, and we start freaking out because when we put it in that context, it makes no sense to us. But what do you think the people reading it at that time were thinking? Can you guys guess? What word in here blows their mind? A woman should learn. That's it. A woman should learn. They don't even get to the second part because right now in the Jewish culture, so much is shifting and suddenly women are allowed to learn. And so when we read this, we sometimes get caught up in the quietness and full submission, but we miss the part that's saying, hey, we're moving forward. It might be a slow journey, and we're trying to all figure out our place here, but you're allowed to learn now and take that. So here it is. Acts starts out talking about the election of church officers. In Acts 1, 15 to 25, if you go through there, you can see that there is no mention of excluding women from serving or voting. At that point, the door has opened. There's a little crack, so the women start being more involved. Acts 2, 1 through 21, but I'm specifically going to focus on 17 to 21. It says, "And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Yea, and my men servants and my maid servants, in those days I will pour my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And it shall be that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Your daughters shall prophesy." Women are recognized as having the gift of prophecy and the privilege of prophesying. Also, both male and females are gifted by the Spirit for the sake of the gospel, so that those who hear and call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Now everyone is becoming part of the conversation. This isn't even a gender war anymore. This is the fact that there's good news to be spread and people are allowed to talk about it no matter who you are. This is starting to shift the whole thing. And then you go into Acts 15, 22, and it says, "Then it seemed good to the apostles and the elders with the whole church to choose men from among them and send them to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. They sent Judas, called Barsabbas, and Silas, leading men as part of the whole church, participated in the decision-making process of the early church." Again, the whole church. This is an inclusive statement here. If you read it in the Greek, it's all-inclusive. And the thing that's crazy is it says they will include the women to participate in picking which men to send out. And so they're slowly moving the dialogue a little bit further. This is incredible because if you read this in context, women have been sidelined for so long and now they're invited to have a voice. Now I know we're getting a little bit heavy into text, but bear with me. I'm not necessarily trying to prove that I deserve my job, okay? But Acts 16, 13 to 14 says, "And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to the riverside, where we supposed there was a place of prayer, and we sat down and spoke to the women who had gathered there. One who heard us was a woman named Lydia." You see, a significant part of Paul's ministry was to convert women. This hadn't been a goal before, because if you just converted the man, it was easy, because then the women would just follow. This moment sheds light on the intentionality of educating women that Paul had. The fact that Paul addresses a group of women with none of their men present reflects his attitude and his attitude to follow Christ. Because if you look at Christ's story, if you read the story of Jesus, in John, there's the story of the Samaritan woman and so many other women that Jesus came in contact with and empowered. Although the Jews would not let women form a synagogue or even count them in the number required for the formation of such, or give them access to the systematic teachings offered there, Paul draws on this group of women to form the nucleus of the Philippian congregation. And he creates house churches. If you know anything about that time, house churches, well, houses in general, were the only place that women had voices. They couldn't sit on the council, they couldn't even really speak on the streets in any way, but they could definitely have more control and a voice in their house. And you see here, they named Lydia, and she housed the congregation in her home, which means Lydia would have been the head of that church community. In Acts 17, 4, 12, and 34, it says, "And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. Many of them, therefore, believed, with not a few Greek women of high standing as well as men. But some men joined him and believed, among them Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them." Luke considers the women among the converts on a parity with the male converts. He makes absolutely no distinction between the two. I would also like to note the pairing, not a few Greek women, as well as men, and among them, Dionysius and Damaris. He intentionally seeks out that there are more and more Greek women joining in this movement. Now this is no longer just a Jewish movement. Gentiles are allowed to be part of the conversation. We go on a little bit further. I'm sorry again. We're going to dig in a little bit more. Acts 18:26. It says, he, Apollos, began to speak boldly in the synagogue. But when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him and expounded him to the way of God more accurately. Here it says Priscilla's name first. This is most unusual when you read these kinds of texts. And the only possible explanation is that she was more important than her husband in the society. If by secular standards, this would mean that she outranked Aquila in terms of social status or maybe even independence wealth. So maybe she inherited something from her family. If you go to Romans 16:3, it says Priscilla is called a fellow worker. If you read that in Greek, it's called synergos. Okay? Synergos. A term used also for Titus in 2 Corinthians and Timothy in Romans 16. Both pastors and both teachers. A fellow worker in this sense would hardly have been silent, submissive, or subordinate. By using these terms, Paul raises a theological claim for himself and his helpers. Their assistance in proclaiming the gospel means that they share with the apostle the burden of the ministry of reconciliation. The verb expounded, ektethemi, is the same verb which describes Peter's public teaching when he defends his eating with the Gentiles against the criticism of the circumcised believers. And is the verb also used to describe Paul's public teaching of the kingdom of God. Here's the thing. The point of all of this textual support is that women shared a large role in the early church and their leadership. The early church disrupted the common practices of the Jewish times and the hierarchical systems put in place. This was not actually that abnormal for people outside of the Jewish community. For the Greeks and the Romans, this is what they had always done. They always had female teachers and leaders, and that was just a very common occurrence. The early church completely disrupted the status quo, however, and because they followed the trajectory that Jesus has placed on them, they began to form these uptight elitist groups, and soon they had to figure out how to bring that leader back down in order for them to openly love people around them. Because people started taking their positions and their roles a little bit more seriously than they had planned. You see, women teaching was just unheard of at that point. Women leading worship, that would have absolutely never happened. And women being part of a council decision, they weren't even invited to council meetings. So then you move into 1 Corinthians 14:34, where it says women should remain silent in the churches. They are not allowed to speak, but must be in submission as the law say. If they want to inquire about something, they should ask their own husbands at home. For it is disgraceful for a woman to speak in the church. I'm breaking a lot of rules today, guys, according to this text. But you see, the context was that before, women were not allowed in the same room as men during worship. However, for this early church, the two were suddenly together in one room. There was typically a literal wall in between the men and women, the sanctuary and where the women and children would hang out. And most of the synagogues wouldn't even allow a woman to step foot inside of it. So picture that unfolding, right? Suddenly, the women go from having been exiled to this side room where they can actually have full-blown conversations with each other because they can't hear what's happening anyways in the meeting. And suddenly, now they're allowed to sit in the church, in the sanctuary. Right? It's a beautiful thing. However, this new disruptive church began to break down a little bit. Because now he has to write this letter saying that you need to remain silent. Here's the problem. The women and the men did not have the same education. The men would often read the Torah in Aramaic, and yet most of the women couldn't understand that. So they would often sit and get absolutely nothing from it. Before long, conversations would start up, and it would sometimes cause disruptions. Have you ever been to a community or a place where you haven't understood the language? Anyone? Yeah. Okay, I'm a professional at ending up in situations where I have no clue what's happening. All right? And just to even give a lame example, I was, like I said, just in the Dominican Republic 2 weeks ago. And I don't know, how many of you guys are Dominican in the room? Anyone? All right. Hey, RC. Right. So Dominican Spanish is on steroids, right? It is out of control. I speak Spanglish very well, which means I act out half of my vocabulary, and then I just say it in English and hope people guess, right? But when you're in the Dominican, people don't slow down, even if you're glazing over and staring at them. And I'm standing with my step-grandmother and my aunt and all my cousins, and suddenly it's like, and I'm like, 20 sentences go by, and I still have no clue what's happening, and I'm just like nodding because they're excited, and so I'm like, I should be excited. I'm agreeing to do all these things that I didn't know I was agreeing to. And near the end of the conversation, I'm like looking at my brother going like, hey, Ivan, what's happening? And he's like, And so pretty soon we start trying to guess what happened in the conversation, right? And before you know it, you're in a full-blown side conversation trying to decipher what's happening in the main conversation, and you're being disruptive, right? That's where my parents give us the evil eye, right? And this is what's happening. We've all been in that situation where we can't communicate, or maybe something's not interesting us that much. And so we're sitting in this church, and they're trying to hear what's going on, but they don't understand the language. And so now the women are sitting in the pews, and they are doing nothing. You see, it's not about them being submissive or silent as a whole. What Paul is really telling this group of women is that during this time, try to be considerate of the people around you. Learn to be the bigger person and learn to respect the space. This is a truly disruptive way of thinking. And then you go to 1 Timothy 2:8 through 15, which is kind of where we started. And it says, therefore, I want the men everywhere to pray, lifting up holy hands without anger or disputing. I also want the women to dress modestly with decency and propriety, adorning themselves, not with elaborate hairstyles or gold pearls or expensive clothes, but with good deeds appropriate for women who profess to worship God. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety. So this still doesn't look very good for me, huh? You're not allowed to wear pearls, you're not allowed to braid your hair, and I need to start shutting up. Right? My personality has struggled with all of these things for years. You see, I don't like being told what to do. I mean, who really does? And so there's two things here. If you look at the historical side of it, the Roman female teachers were known for using their authority to punish young male pupils in the city. These female teachers would dress like the goddesses of Rome with braids and jewels, and often use their power to humiliate or entice their pupils into forms of worship that caused the teacher to feel a sense of power and control. That's the society that many of these leaders were coming into the new movement from. This was what the Greek and Roman mindset had been for so long. And so the concern Paul is addressing here is that some of the women in this new movement that was booming had so many Gentiles in it, overpowering the Jewish cultures, which was good in a lot of senses, but they were beginning to use their power to oppress some of the men and people around them. You see, authority is actually a poor translation of the Greek word Paul uses in 1 Timothy 2:12. The Greek word Paul uses for authority in this passage is authentein. It means to abuse authority or misuse power, using authority over people in a negative way. Paul's restriction was given in the context of a personal letter to Timothy giving advice about a specific issue in the church of Ephesus. There is no command from God here and no suggestion that Paul was trying to establish some church policy for all time. It's simply that there was a group of women teaching, which again tells us this was becoming common. And so he was addressing the specific group to remind the women that they were beginning to act like the Roman female leaders who had dressed like the goddesses and abused the power during their teachings. So here, we can move beyond the shock that women are leaders in religious leaders in this new movement. Here, what is most pointed and critical is that Paul is essentially telling those women that were abusing their power to learn to practice submission, to learn to show oneness with the people around them. He was essentially putting their egos in check, holding them accountable for their actions, and reminding people that being a leader often requires submission and sometimes silence, so you can actually hear what people are saying to you. In faith communities, it's often hard to tear down walls and sometimes easy for certain groups to begin to feel a sense of importance and lord that over people. They begin to abuse and overuse their power, and they begin to hurt the people around them, whether they know it or not. We are all called to a compassionate way of life. Diffusing anger and distance can often be found in something so simple, like a hug. And other times it gets a little bit more complicated and goes into the fluid act of compassionate living. Yet once you tear down the wall between you, magic can actually happen. That's what Jesus did. He tore down the walls and negativity and elitism of oppressive behaviors and began to build up love, compassion, and grace. There's a story that has defined so much of my career and so much, I guess, of my adult life slash childhood life. How many of you guys have heard of this awesome entertainment called Your Story Hour? Anyone? My jam, right? I had the records, I had the cassettes, and that's what we listened to every Friday night and every Saturday morning before church. And I love these stories. And when I was writing this sermon, I was actually thinking about one of my favorite ones, and it's a story that I'm going to now tell you, but it's way more exciting, and you can totally YouTube it, so I encourage you to YouTube it. But there's this guy and this lady, and they're married, and they've been living on this farm for a really long time. It's Jim and Cora. But now their property in Pennsylvania has become too important for the society around them. It's a good place for malls and shopping and all that stuff. And so now they've been asked to sell it and move. Now, this was the land that had been inherited from their father, and so they were really sad. But finally, they decided maybe it's a time for change. So there we go. They jump in the car, they sell the farm, and they decide instead of just going straight to a farm and buying it, what we're going to do is we're going to make a vacation out of this. We're going to go on a road trip. And so they load everything up and they decide to just start driving across the U.S. They go start visiting all these farms as they drive from Pennsylvania, and soon they end up in Wisconsin. And they're in this one little town, and they find it so beautiful and magical, and they like the way it looks, and it just feels right. And they're like, you know what, we should check this one out. Let's see if they have any land for sale. And so sure enough, they go to the realtor's office and they're like, oh yeah, there's one property, that's about all we have, but I'm happy to show it to you. And so they get in the car with the realtor and they go to the land. It's big farmland, it's beautiful, it has a lake on it, the house is huge, the kitchen's perfect, the buildings are a little worn down, the fences are needing a little bit of mending and paint, but overall it's the perfect place. It's the first property in so long that they've seen that they actually both agree on. And so they're like, oh man, we're kind of nervous to see like how much it costs and like why has no one stayed here very long? And soon they finally get up the guts and they're like, so how much does it cost? And the man goes, well, it's actually really affordable. And he tells them, he's like, we haven't had that many tenants stay long here, so we're hoping to get new people in. And he's like, really? So they say, okay, we'll think about it for a little bit. They go back, they get in their car, and immediately turn around and go back to the property to figure out what's wrong with it. They get to the property, they walk all around it, and nothing's wrong. It's an ideal space. It's the perfect property. There's perfect farmland there, and they cannot figure out what it is that's wrong with it. So finally, Cora comes up with an idea, and she's like, hey, let's go ask one of the neighbors or maybe someone in town, and maybe they'll tell us the gossip, and we'll figure out what happened, right? And so sure enough, they go and they find one of the first neighbors out on their lawn. And so they say, hey, we're looking at buying the old Phillips place. Any words of advice? And she's like, oh, I can tell you why no one's lived there long. And they're like, okay. And they're like, oh, it's that old Mr. Grimes next door. And they're like, okay. And they're like, oh, he's an evil, evil man. He is so malicious, and he's always trying to hurt the people that live there. And he just runs them out of town almost immediately as they get there. And they're like, really? And she just goes on and on. And she's like, he's the devil himself. And Jim pauses, and then he begins to smile. And he says, is he the devil? And he's like, yeah. He goes, well, if he tries anything on me or my wife, I will kill that old devil. And the lady's like, oh, no, no, no. And of course, his wife smacks him, dear. Because you don't say that to people you don't know, right? And so he just smiles, and they go on their way, and he decides that he's going to buy that property. So sure enough, they buy that property. A little bit of time goes by. They're mending the houses and the fence and getting the crop in the fields, and everything seems to be going well. A solid month goes by before anything weird happens. And then the day comes where he's walking out to milk the cows, and he opens the barn door, and there are no cows in the barn. So he goes on a hunt for them. He finds soon enough that the cows had been let out through a cut fence. And he's like, oh, old Mr. Grimes, let's cut the fence. At this point, he had a dog that he had inherited, and so the dog is running around, and they're rounding up the cows, and when he's trying to decide what to do with the fence, he decides, instead of mending the fence, I'm going to put a gate in there. He's like, that way, if old Mr. Grimes wants to let the cows out again, he doesn't have to cut the fence. He can just open the gate. And so he goes on, puts the gate in, things move on. A few days go by, and then something else happens. He goes, and he's working out and milking the cows, and suddenly his wife is yelling and yelling and yelling inside the house, and he goes in and he finds out that no water is coming through. And so then he goes on a hunt trying to find out what happened to the water. He goes down by the lake and he finds that there's this pipe burst behind a bush. And he could see that it was dug up and that the pipe was cut. And so he goes and he starts mending the pipe and he then puts it above ground. And he's like, this way, if old Mr. Grimes wants, he can just cut the pipe above ground. He doesn't have to work so hard. A little bit more time goes on, and that next day, the wife comes running out. She's like, honey, 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 I just had a Mr. Grimes sighting. And he's like, oh, yeah? And she's like, yeah, he left in a truck full of potatoes. I guess he's going into town. And he's like, perfect. This is what I've been waiting for. And so he runs next door, and he begins to walk around and look at the property. He comes back, and he's like, Cora, that place is a mess. The buildings are slightly falling apart. It definitely needs repainting. The porch looks a little unstable. The weeds are taking over his garden. I don't even know how this man eats. And so she says, you know what? We have plenty of fresh stuff. And so they put together a basket, and they put fruits and vegetables. She had some pie from dinner the night before, and she wraps it up all nice, and then they sneak over, and they put it on his doorstep. That night got a little bit later than she had planned, and she had done laundry. So the laundry was out a little bit later than usual. And as the sun's going down, she's like, it's just not dry. She's like, but it's not supposed to rain tonight, so I'm just going to leave this out here. The next morning, she wakes up, and guess what happened to her laundry? All of her clean laundry is all over the ground in the mud with footprints all over it, and the clothesline is completely cut. She is livid. And she starts yelling, Jim, what are we going to do? This awful man just keeps messing up everything. We can't do anything. She's just yelling and yelling and yelling. And soon he's like, don't worry, honey, I'll fix the line. And he picks up the clothes. He's like, you go inside. I'll pick up all the clothes and we'll do laundry together. So he does just that. That night, she's still a little flustered and a little angry. And so at worship that night, he decides to pull out the old family Bible. And he begins to read her Bible verses about turning the other cheek and loving your neighbor and all this stuff. And finally, she's like, I see what you're doing. And he's like, yeah, I know. And she's like, you want me to love him. And he's like, it's kind of my project. I just want to, you know, it's a good challenge to see how long I can just love this guy who's always trying to be mean to us. She's like, all right, fair enough. Tomorrow, I'm planning on baking some bread, so will you bring a loaf of bread over to him? And he was like, sounds perfect. Then they go to bed. The next morning, he wakes up and he goes to milk the cows as usual every morning. And as he's walking out the door, he starts yelling for his dog. And he's yelling and yelling and yelling, and he can't find him. And he figured out maybe he's down at the lake or already with the cows. And as he walks into the barn, he looks and there's all the cows. And then he sees his dog and he's like, hey, there you are. And the dog doesn't move. He's a little bit closer and he's like, hey, hey, dog still doesn't move. The dog was dead. He was mortified. He picked up the dog and ran into town, ran to the vet. The vet said the dog has been poisoned. He comes home and him and Cora are just heartbroken over this dog. And she was like, you have to go over there and tell him that this is not allowed. We are neighbors. You can't be this cruel to people. And she just goes off on Jim. And Jim says, so you don't want me to take the loaf of bread over? And she was like, fine, take the loaf of bread over. And so sure enough, he walks over and he puts the loaf of bread on the doorstep and he walks back home. They were very sad that night. The next morning, he's out in the garden and he sees the truck go by full of potatoes on the way to town. And as it starts going right in front of his property, the truck hits a mud puddle and gets stuck clear down to the axle. And he's spinning his wheels, and Mr. Grimes is getting more and more frustrated because his wheels are spinning. And Jim sits for a moment in silence, and then without a word, he goes and he grabs his tractor, he pulls up to the truck, he hooks up the wire, he pulls the truck out, he unhooks the wire, and he's just about to get back in his tractor when the door opens and you just hear, stop, stop, what are you doing? And old Mr. Grimes standing in front of him. Mr. Grimes doesn't know what to do. He's like, what is wrong with you? I've done everything mean to you. I've cut your fence. I've broken your pipes. I killed your dog. He's like, why are you still being nice to me? And Jim simply said, welcome home, neighbor. And it's this moment where they shake hands and they go into the house and he introduces him to Cora and he begins to tell his story and all of the baggage that he has and all these things that he's done that's so horrible. And they just sit there and they say, but we're neighbors. When you do something wrong, I'm going to do everything I can to make it right. It's a shared experience. And this is what's happening is these walls have been put up and these negative things have been put up and people have been hurt and people are being oppressive and people are manipulating situations and people are being controversial, whatever it may be. And our jobs as Christians are not to stand there and let that be the status quo. Our job is not to accept oppression and necessarily rule everything on our own. Our job is to show love and compassion and to reach beyond those bounds and lift those people up that have been broken and hurt for so long that that's the only way they know how to live. This text here are not necessarily about the role of women in ministry. What these texts are referring to are the amount of submission and patience that comes with leadership and living life in general, of being a parent, of being a person in your community that has a vision or a passion. You see, we can learn to live in compassion. We can learn that we are in placed in positions of power or even the possibility of power to bring freedom, not to oppress people. We learn to be humble leaders rather than tyrants, leaders in society, in the home, in the church, anyone, anywhere that's claiming to follow Christ. We have a responsibility. We are responsible for killing the devil. We are responsible for tearing down the walls that people or even ourselves have put up, replacing the divisive, condemning, condescending walls with good, with inclusion, life-breathing, and empowerment to live differently and better. Realizing that as a leader, as a person in power over yourself and the people around us, we must take time to build healing in our communities and in our world. Church should not be a community that reflects abuse of power, but a power that heals those who have been abused. Christianity was a place of healing for people in all spectrums of life. A place that reminded that being powerful isn't actually the end all. There is more to the story. Christianity was a reminder that someone once lived so different and beautifully and compassionately that he gave a voice to the outcasts. Life to the broken. And power to the lowly. And this is the key to what it means to be a Christ follower. We follow Christ's example. We are a power that heals those who have been abused by the world around them. We learn not to abuse our power, but learn to share it and think of the person over ourselves. When we do this and we begin living true, authentic, caring, compassionate lives in whatever role we live in, we are then experiencing the kingdom of heaven.